You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 21st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. And we are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Oh, indeed. So fashionable today. Why is the Dollar Lunch District so much more fashionable today than it was, say, last week? Well, that's because I'm not there. Yes, in fact, my absence raises the fashion quotient of any area that I'm not in by... sometimes, just a matter of degrees, exponentially at times. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, I am on vacation, but that doesn't mean that you shan't hear all new fresh content from the Majority Report. Indeed, today on the program, from several weeks ago, when I attended Family USA's Health Action 2012, three interviews. Dr. Valerie Arkush of the National Physicians Alliance. Congressman John Sarbanes of Maryland. And Professor Timothy Jost, law professor on the upcoming Supreme Court case on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. This is fascinating stuff. There's one element of that case that I find very, very strange. And you should trust me on this because I went to law school for one entire year, which is when you take all the courses on what's strange in the law. Actually, that's not true. I did go for long enough to know that I could get sued for implying that about law schools. And so with all those lawyers at an institution like that, you don't want to mess around. So, ladies and gentlemen, sit back, relax, unless, of course, you're driving, in which case, you know, just stay where you are. Keep your hands on the wheel. 10-1, I guess. I am on vacation. I'm not relaxing. In fact, in some respects, it's been 2 days of vacation. My daughter is off from school. I'm probably counting down the hours before I can get back to work. For all I know, right now, I'm hiding out in the bathroom, just trying to escape my family because it's been now 2 days since the end of the weekend, and all the sort of dreams I had about what I would do on this vacation have by now all just been washed away. I don't have a PlayStation. I can't play video games. Probably not allowed to read in my house. You know how this goes. Right now I'm probably just, I don't know, cleaning up the dishes from the macaroni and cheese I made Mila. So sit back, enjoy, and remember, the only way this show is able to reach your ears is because of the largesse and the sense of responsibility of the members of this program. So look to your left, look to your right. You see that person to your left or to your right? Well, they're a member of this program. If there's nobody there, it turns out you're the person who's supposed to join.
and you can do so at majority.fm right now, 33 cents a day. So check it out. Join the program. Remember, we got a survey at majority.fm. Take that survey. It'll help us maybe get some advertising in the future. Okay, so stick around. Three interviews in a row. Valerie Arcouche, John Sarbanes, and Timothy Jost. I hope you enjoy. Don't forget, later in this week, Lawrence Lessig. Representatives of our sponsor, Just Coffee, from justcoffee.coop, on what fair trade means and what their business is all about. Also, later in the week, Dimitar Saslov, one of the most premier astronomers in the country. And then, at the end of the week, we'll be talking to Derek Jensen, one of the premier authors about environmentalism. I mean, he's an activist, too. He's a radical environmentalist. It's a fascinating interview, philosopher. I think you'll really enjoy that one, which is not to say that you won't enjoy these, too. They're all slightly different flavor, folks, because that's the way we roll here. Okay, see you tomorrow. We are at Health Action 2012, put on by Families USA. And with me now is Valerie Arcouche. She is the
President
of the National Physicians Alliance. Valerie, what is the National Physicians Alliance?
The National Physicians Alliance is a multi-specialty physician organization that was founded in 2005. We believe that all people should have access to decent quality health care, and we've worked very hard to get to that place here in the United States.
And so one of the things you work with is you work directly with physicians to educate them, to provide support. Do you lobby on their behalf? I mean, what is your relationship with physicians?
So our members, our contributing members, are mostly physicians, although we have others that contribute to our organization. But our goal is to help physicians become engaged in their communities. We believe that it's part of our professional responsibility to advocate on behalf of our patients, and that physicians should be involved in their communities to do that. So we give physicians all the tools that they need to do that, including education, training, to talk to the media, how to write op-ed pieces, all that sort of work, but mostly education about the issues. We work a lot in coalitions with other organizations.
When you say education about the issues, to educate the general public from the of the perspective of physicians on health issues, or to educate the physicians?
We actually do both. So physicians, as I'm sure you know, are pretty busy in their day-to-day practices, and they don't always have time to keep up with all of the policy issues. So sort of step one in what we typically do is help educate our own physicians about some of the current policy issues. And then we help those physicians go out and talk to their public, to their communities, to their patients about those issues as they see fit.
What is your organization's take on the Affordable Care Act? What are the benefits that you see that will accrue from it? What are the things that you hope to improve upon?
Well, there are a number of benefits for our patients with the Affordable Care Act. I think number one is the fact that right now children cannot be denied care because of pre-existing conditions, and in 2014 that will be the case for all people in the United States. They cannot be denied care because of pre-existing conditions.
Now, as it stands now in terms of pre-existing conditions, what are available for adults?
Well, right now, if a person is currently uninsured, one of the primary reasons is that they can't get health insurance that they can afford, or sometimes even get health insurance offered to them because they may have a pre-existing condition.
Uh-huh.
So unless they happen to work for a large employer who has a big group plan that doesn't discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions, they're often out of luck. People that are self-employed or work as consultants, things like that. And so right now, if a person's been uninsured for 6 months because of a pre-existing condition, there are some options for them. But that's somewhat limited, but beginning in 2014, insurance companies will not be able to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions, and in fact, they won't even be able to charge them more for an insurance policy.
Right, and now there are high-risk pools where those people can go into. They'll be paying more, but they will be able to get at least some measure.
You know, not necessarily. It really depends upon the state. Some states have more generous high-risk pools than others, and so really depending upon where they live and what their personal financial resources are, they may not be able to get coverage.
Interesting. And so
That being one of the biggest benefits, what do you see as one of the biggest shortcomings of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think that there are still opportunities to figure out how to control the rising costs of health care. The Affordable Care Act begins to do that in a very important way. There are parts of the Affordable Care Act that will begin to restructure how hospitals and doctors are paid, and what that means is instead of paying for quantity of care, which is what happens right now, it will start to pay doctors and hospitals for the quality of care.
Now, this is a function of comparative effectiveness committees?
Well, not exactly. That's sort of one piece of it, but really where this is centered in something called accountable care organizations, which will be an effort to encourage doctors to work together, so a primary care doctor to communicate with specialist doctors and a hospital that are all taking care of a patient in order to better coordinate the care for that patient. Anybody with more than one medical problem can tell you right now that there is oftentimes very poor coordination between their doctors. And so this will be an effort to get everybody rowing the boat in the same direction, and doctors will actually get higher have the option of getting some basically like a bonus payment if they do that care coordination well.
I see. And the reason why the lack of care coordination is not cost effective is because it creates more medical problems that then must be addressed with more care.
Right, exactly. So we just kind of have this negative feedback loop where, for instance, right now, there's very little incentive for hospitals to make sure that patients go home with proper home nursing care or physical therapy or whatever that patient needs, because, quite frankly, the hospital gets paid again if the patient comes back to the hospital in 2 or 3 weeks with a problem. In the future, the idea will be not to pay hospitals for preventable infections that a patient acquires in the hospital, and not to pay hospitals if a patient bounces back in 2 or 3 weeks after discharge when they could have been kept out of the hospital with a little bit of help at home.
Now, when you say not to pay the hospitals, who is it that's not paying in those instances? Are we talking about these are changes to Medicare? These are changes to, insurance companies are going to change the way that they pay, private insurance companies?
Well, in the Affordable Care Act, that covers Medicare.
Right,
that'll be a Medicare program. But historically, when Medicare starts to make changes like this, it's often the case that both state Medicaid programs as well as private health insurers follow on. And in fact, in some cases, in some states already, state Medicaid programs and some private insurers have stopped paying for things like hospital-acquired infections that are felt to be preventable.
Interesting. And so at first, the cost containment for the Affordable Care Act is really just going to be a Medicare cost containment, and there's hope that these models will spread through the entire industry.
Right. That's correct.
Because they'll be shown as effective. I mean, theoretically, the insurance companies have the same incentive to reduce the cost of care. And we know that the private sector, the rate of increase in cost of care is already significantly higher than that in the context of Medicare. Let's talk briefly, just for a moment, in terms of the relationship between physicians and pharmaceuticals, because what you're talking about is a misalignment of incentives with the hospitals and essentially people's health, sadly, which is almost one of the most depressing things, I think, one of the most depressing things that could be put together in a sentence. The idea that we just don't make as much if people don't get sick again. So we have no investment in keeping them well as soon as they walk outside the door. There's also that sort of misalignment of incentives with pharmaceuticals and other medical procedures. There's that famous piece by Atul Gawande where he compared two towns in Texas, basically controlled for everything. One had 30% higher medical costs because doctors owned essentially a lot of MRIs or whatever it was. So what does your organization do in that regard relative to pharmaceuticals?
Well, first, let me just say that we, our goal is to make sure that all those incentives are properly aligned. So we want all the incentives to be to keep our patients healthy. So that's why we've been very supportive of the Affordable Care Act, because we believe that it starts to realign the incentives so that people are healthy and there's every incentive to keep our population healthy. Specifically relating to pharmaceuticals, there's been a for many, many years, the pharmaceutical industry has, as probably everyone's familiar with, sent drug representatives into physicians' offices to tell them about new medications. And they often come with lunch and gifts and other things for the office staff or the doctors. And it turns out that pharmaceutical companies have been able to do something called data mining for many, many years. And what that means is that when a patient gets a prescription filled at the pharmacy, the fact that that prescription was filled goes into a database, and it's logged into a database with a number of the prescribing physician. And the pharmaceutical industry is able to figure out which physician it is that wrote that prescription by buying information from the American Medical Association that links the name of the doctor to their number. So that when a drug rep goes into a doctor's office, they usually know exactly how much of that rep's company's drug that doctor has prescribed in the last several weeks or month or couple of months. And so usually it's the job of that rep to try to increase the amount
That's
of
horrible.
Prescribing that that,
that
doctor is doing.
That is horrible. And so what your physicians aware of this?
We do. And I have to tell you that I was certainly unaware of this until several years ago. It's not something that a lot of physicians necessarily know about. So the National Physicians Alliance has a campaign that we like to call the Unbranded Doctor, which encourages physicians to keep all that pharma stuff out of their offices. Don't take the free lunch. Don't take the pen. Don't take the notepad. And instead, seek information from more neutral sources that are more science-based. There's a whole effort now called academic detailing, where nurses and doctors come in and do teaching about new drugs. Because clearly doctors need to learn about
right.
new drugs.
But they
shouldn't
be sold.
They're not their marketing.
Right.
That's right. They're not their marketing. They're presenting the science. And that's what we strongly encourage.
Well, Valerie Arkush of the National Physicians Alliance, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to talk with you.
We're at the Health Action 2012 conference put on by Families USA, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Congressman John Sarbanes. He is the congressman from the 3rd Congressional District in Maryland, and welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So this past week, aside from the political race that's happening with the Republicans, the most interesting story in my mind took place with this this blackout that took place on Wednesday of internet companies fighting the PIPA and SOPA acts in both the House and the Senate. These acts ostensibly to protect the copyright protections for Hollywood and content makers. Give me your sense of why it was that the most amount of votes that changed during this week, it's something like 24 senators, I think, or somewhere in that neighborhood, and I don't know if just as many congresspeople, literally changed their position on this in a day. Most of them were Republicans. Why is that?
Well, I think anybody who changed their position on this was probably doing it because they hadn't been paying enough attention to the actual language of the act. Because if you were to just read a very small summary of it, it would sound reasonable, right? You want to protect content, you want to protect copyright holders and all the rest of it.
Yes, everybody's against stealing.
From piracy and stealing and rogue websites in other countries and all this kind of stuff. So you describe it that way, and you're like, sure, that's something I should be for. But then, you know, the other perspective was brought to bear and done in a way that's kind of created a firestorm over the last few days, and done fairly, because there ought to be a very careful and spirited debate about where you draw the line here. You know, what is the balance? Now, you know, both sides have a good argument to make. I mean, you know, people that produce content, it's fair for them to want to protect that, and we have a tradition in this country of trying to give people ownership of their talents and their intellectual property and so forth in a way that can be protected. At the same time, you don't want to overreach and make it so broad that you begin to compromise a free and open internet, you know, free speech and other issues that we also take very seriously. So that's a debate that's going on right now, and, you know, we'll see where it ends up. I don't think in its current form either PIPA or SOPA is workable and could pass at this point, so there will be some other forms of this coming forward.
Right. And of course, our tradition of protecting that which we all sort of bundle up in this notion of intellectual property. I'm not terribly fond of that term. And as a content maker myself, I'm sensitive to this issue. But I mean, of course, the reason why we have a tradition of protecting those works is to promote the creation of those works. And right. There really is no data that suggests in any way what is happening online is in any way inhibiting the creation or the profitability of that content. But leave that aside. What do you make? I see this as a battle between two industries. And one of these industries had access to a lot of people. They have a better relationship, frankly, with the people who use their product. And they brought that to bear. 4.5 million people in one day signing an email list. Somebody just made a lot of money on that email list, too. But aside from that, and there are a lot of Democrats who get their money from Hollywood. And one of the chief lobbyists from Hollywood was a former senator, Democratic senator, who also, sadly, suggested he would not become a lobbyist. But be that as it may, people's plans change.
They do.
Green
will do that to you.
Yes. Let's talk about money in politics and how it impacts these type of debates and how much that shuts out people.
Look, there's very little that's not being influenced by money in politics right now. And I think at stake, I don't want to overstate this, but I don't think you can. I think that democracy as we know it or wish we could know it is really threatened by what's going on right now. Certainly since Citizens United, where you now have the ability for corporations and very wealthy individuals to spend unlimited amounts targeting candidates. But, you know, even before Citizens United, the influence of special interest money in politics was huge. And if we don't push back against that, we're going to continue to have this situation where legislation that should be in the public interest quickly gets hijacked and is turned into something that really only advances special interest. And if you look at the anger of the public out there, whether it's from some elements of the Tea Party or from the Occupy Wall Street, much of it comes from this feeling that government has been taken over by special interests, and people are angry and cynical about that, and that's why we keep getting wave elections, 06, 08, 2010. We may get it again this fall. People are fed up, and they want to get control again of their government. I think there's a number of ways you do this.
Special interests, we mean moneyed interests, don't we?
We mean moneyed interests, absolutely. People who can ask for a meeting with you or your staff, and next week hold out the promise to you that they can do a fundraiser and deliver $10,000 or $15,000 to your coffers, or they can write a PAC check.
Right. Now, and it means that you have to do a lot less work and cold calling your neighbors.
And I believe that most members of Congress struggle mightily to maintain their independent judgment, notwithstanding the money that is showered on them in this process. But let's face it, human beings are human beings. And at some level, it affects the judgment of an individual if you got that kind of money in the process. And certainly, collectively, the institution can't concentrate on doing its work when you have that much money coming in.
And it's also just a matter of access. If I talk to five people a day and all five of them happen to be millionaires, I'm going to have a fairly specific perspective on the world.
And the only solution to this is public financing of campaigns. That's how, that's the biggest super PAC there is, which is the American people saying, you know what, we'll put the election system on our shoulders and we'll finance it going forward.
Is that enough? And I ask this because, you know, you mentioned Citizens United. I think Citizens United is just maybe the cherry on top of the problem. And it's more about our elections than it is about our governing. And there's plenty of data out there and a great report from a professor at Princeton who shows that over the past 30 years, policy outcomes, you can predict what the policy outcome is because you need to only see what the wealthy in this country want, and right, that's what it ends up being, regardless of party, regardless of who controls Congress or the executive, it doesn't matter. So you're talking about reforms that would take place relative to elections. And I understand how that would impact. You don't have to worry about who's giving you money as much. Do we also need to sort of change the way people exit Congress and your staffers will exit Congress? Because your staffers, with all due respect, there's one sitting here, may be interested in getting a job with Verizon. So when the telecommunications people come...
Sure, we can look at that, but you know what? If you fix the first problem we're talking about, if the money for campaigns was coming from the public instead of from the special interest, frankly, that lobbyist coming back in from K Street who used to be on your staff wouldn't have nearly as much sway because they're not in a position to write a check. You don't need it from them anymore. The reason they get the access, the reason there is a revolving door is because these moneyed interests are in a position to hire these people up and then deploy them back onto Capitol Hill to get their wishes carried out. If I don't, and no other member of Congress needs to rely on that source of funding to run my campaign, if instead it's coming from the public, then we build an immunity to that kind of influence over time. And I think it's the only way we're going to be able to do it. Now, there's something called the Fair Elections Now Act, which is a reform legislation which create a public financing system. Basically says if you can go recruit a certain number of grassroots donors defined as $100 or less, then you get access to dollars from a public fund as a candidate.
So a matching funds type of situation.
Kind of a matching thing. It's a good idea. It's not law. Probably won't be for some time. But I decided, you know what? I believe in this enough. I'm going to model it in my own campaign. So what I did this time was I went to a bunch of traditional donors. I said, help me create a special fund that mimics the Fair Elections Fund.
Uh-huh.
And I will pledge to you that I won't touch that money. It'll go into a separate account in my campaign, and I won't touch it till I go get 1,000 grassroots donors. I'll show how this can work. So we raised it. It's in the bank. It's off limits to me. And now I'm working to build that grassroots network to show that we can do this because I want the grassroots donor to own the process, not the special interest.
Do you think that... Because I want to talk to you about what the path to victory is to get that done. But it starts with the voter response to what you're doing.
No question. The public is going to make this happen.
Right. And so do you have any sense, do you have any way of telling right now what public reaction is to this? In other words, theoretically, the way that something like this is going to get adopted is if one candidate in an election opts into a system like
this. That's right.
And then sort of uses as a moral bludgeon, if you will, maybe that's the wrong word, but to shame the other candidate into do it because the response from the electorate. Are you finding the electorate is responding well to this?
Everyone I talk to is so fed up with the influence of money in politics that they're looking for solutions that make sense. And whether that's trying to push back on Citizens United, which I say is just one part of the problem, or whether it's trying to get us to public financing, they believe in doing this. Now, they're cynical, so they don't really know whether it can happen. But if you could say, frankly, if you could say to members of Congress and to the public, we can snap our fingers and get ourselves from where we are now to a system that works this way, a public financing system, I think it would be embraced. The problem is how do you get
right
from here to there? And one way you can do it is begin to model it. And I have the opportunity to try to do that, so I've decided I have the responsibility to show how this would work. And, you know, I'm not taking PAC money or anything like that. I'm trying to sort of adhere to a model. Now, I don't do it righteously. I know many of my colleagues aren't in a position to test out an experiment like this right now. But I am, and I'm trying to do that. And the response we get from people is tremendous. Look, I had a fella come up to me at a house party a couple of years ago. He says, I like what you do. I'm a big supporter. He says, I have one complaint. I said, what's that? He says, you've never asked me to support you financially. He said, I can only give you $25. I can't afford more than that, but I'd be proud to do it. And what I realize is there's a whole group of people, the majority of the citizens out there, who can now with the internet be brought in to a grassroots support network for you and are proud to be part of that. And the beauty of it is the $25 donor is not asking for special favors. They just want you to go do the right thing. And here's the last point I'll make. In the age of super PACs, if you're in the last 4 weeks of a campaign and a super PAC comes after you, you can't go to the traditional donors because they're maxed out by then. The only recourse you have to protect yourself is if you've built a grassroots network of 5, 10,000 people who you can turn to and say, folks, here comes the super PAC. I need your $25 contribution now. Help me out. And you can fight back. So even the traditional fundraisers who, you know, always could raise the money, if they don't build that grassroots donor network, they're going to be vulnerable going forward. And that's why I'm committing so much of my focus right now to building out this thing. We've got a grassrootsdonor.com is our website where we're trying to pilot this. And stay tuned because I think it can work.
At grassrootsdonor.com, are you what happens there? Are you soliciting people for the bigger fund?
No, that's we already got that. This is asking people to become the $10, $5 donor that gets us to where we can unlock the fund that we've created. So it's building that grassroots network out. We're going to do it obviously focused in my own district, but also I think it can be a good model for other candidates across the country.
Grassrootsdonor.com. Congressman John Sarbanes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Continuing our coverage from Families USA Health Action Conference 2012, with me now is Timothy Jost. He is professor at Washington Lee University Law School and also representative of the National Association of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Professor, walk me through the Supreme Court case. I know that there are four elements. The date has been announced now, the last couple of days of March. The court's going to be looking at this, right, I think, over the course of 3 days.
Yes, that's correct. They're going to have 5.5 hours of oral arguments, and the decision will probably come down late June.
And there are four elements to this case.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you walk us through those four elements?
Yes. The one that's gotten all the attention has been the minimum coverage requirement, which is often called the individual mandate, the provision of the Affordable Care Act that requires people who can afford health insurance to purchase health insurance. And the Congress believed that it could adopt that under the Commerce Clause, which gives Congress power to regulate interstate commerce, and the clause of the Constitution that allows Congress to tax, because if you don't purchase insurance, the penalty is a tax. That is being challenged by the states, and that's by the decision that the Supreme Court is going to make. Prior to it being able to make that decision, however, it will have to decide whether a statute called the Anti-Injunction Act that prohibits courts from enjoining taxes prohibits them from considering it at all. If it is a tax, then they're going to have to wait till the tax is actually assessed, which won't be till 2015.
And that's a question of standing, essentially.
That's a question of jurisdiction, yes. It's and at least one federal court of appeals has said, no, we can't hear this case until 2015. And then the third question is, if they decide that the minimum coverage requirement is unconstitutional, then does the whole statute go, which is extremely unlikely, or will they only take that provision out and leave the rest of it stand, or maybe a couple of other insurance reforms go with it?
That is the notion often is...
Severability.
Yeah. And now the fourth, my understanding, there's a fourth element to this.
Yeah, question. And in fact, I think that's the most important question before the court.
I find that one just bizarre, frankly.
And pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
What the states have claimed is that the provision of the statute that... that requires states that participate in Medicaid, which is right now all the states, to expand coverage to cover everyone below 138% of poverty in 2014 is unconstitutional, basically because the federal government can't tell the states what to do.
And even with money
even if they
that the
pay
feds
for it,
are paying for.
Even if they pay 100%. And the idea is, and I read their brief last week, their main case they rely on is a case that's comes from before the New Deal, from when the Supreme Court was still striking down New Deal legislation, and that says that the federal government can't coerce the states into participating in federal programs, and they say Medicaid is so important and such a big part of our budgets that if you tell us to do anything under Medicaid, you're coercing us if you threaten to take away our money if we don't do it. So that decision, if the Supreme Court would decide in their favor, and I have to say there has never been a federal court that has struck down a statute under this theory. It's a theory that they're making up out of dribs and drabs of other cases. But if the Supreme Court would strike it down, an awful lot of federal programs, civil rights programs, education programs, et cetera, would go with it. So this is a major issue.
And we don't have much time, so let's continue to focus on this. I think the argument about the mandate and the commercial clause and the state government, the commerce clause, and the idea that by not buying insurance, you're actually affecting the whole market because of the way that insurance works.
Yeah.
I mean, we hear a lot about that, but this element to me of the case is. The one that has the most potential to wreak havoc, just as you've said.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the last time there was anything like this was during the 80s. Mm-hmm. I was, I think, around 17 or 18 years, 16, 17 years old, and they raised the drinking age.
Right.
Just as I was about to hit 18.
Yeah.
To 21, they tied it into
federal highway funds. Yeah.
So did that ever go to the Supreme Court?
Yes, and there was a case called South Dakota versus Dole because South Dakota fought for teenage drinking, apparently, and they went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held that the Congress could require the states to raise the drinking age, and they walked through a number of tests that are applied in spending clause cases and said all those had been satisfied. And then at the end, they said in what we call dicta, where the Supreme Court is just kind of musing about things, they said, but you could have a situation where the threat to the state was so draconian that it would become coercive, and that might raise constitutional questions.
But that would almost go, if you looked at this on a spectrum, that would almost go the opposite direction from what this Medicare thing is. In terms of, I know you're looking at me like the concept, but my point is that they're leveraging highway funds to raise a drinking age. There's a tenuous connection there.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me that it would be more draconian if they were saying, like, hey, you know, we're not going to give you any funds unless you do, you know, unless you change your state flag or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see that is coercive.
Yeah.
But this is a situation where you're saying, like, you know, this program that you have, we're just going to make it larger. There's no unfunded mandate. Maybe 3 years down the road, you may have to pick up 10% of it, but you're going to save so much money in the meantime that it'll balance out.
Yeah.
Why did the Supreme Court? I assume there are other cases that they could have taken relative to this to the Affordable Care Act. Why did they take this question?
That's a mystery. Again, there both the district court and the Court of Appeals rejected the claim, and the Supreme Court took cert on it. Four justices thought this was a question worth talking about, but it is a bit of a mystery. Because,
do we know which four?
No. because if they would, it just takes four to approve a cert petition. It may have been six or eight or nine, but we know that at least four did. But again, they will be making up law out of the whole cloth if they decide to do this. They'll be picking bits and pieces of earlier cases and saying that that we think we're going to change the law.
I presume you watch the court quite a bit. Can you speculate as to what's happening? Like, it just seems to me that this is law that is fairly settled, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And that the idea that they would affirm this law seems redundant and silly to me. I mean, I don't know.
I only
had 1 year of law school.
Yeah.
So I'm going to
Well, that's the most important year. But obviously they're going to say something about it. And given the current composition of the court, they'll probably say something that a lot of us won't like. I really don't think they're going to strike it down, but they might. And if they do, it's just going to be, it will be a major problem. For one thing, I think that the Medicaid expansions are probably more key to the coverage expansions on the whole of the Affordable Care Act than the individual mandate is. So it's going to be interesting to watch. But I think it's important that people be aware of what's at stake in this case. Because once again, you know, there goes education funding, there goes transportation funding, there goes some of the civil rights bills turn on federal funding to the states.
The upside, though, of course, is that the drinking age in Montana will probably be about 12.
Possibly, yes.
So is it also possible when you, as someone who watches the court, that Scalia, Alito, Roberts, Thomas, they may say, like, you know, it's worth taking this because if we want to start to chip away at the at federal authority, this is a good place to start.
Yeah, and that is clearly the agenda of some.
So they don't necessarily overturn the case, but they start to build some form of case law that goes forward that people can start to cite in future cases.
Yep.
If you look to Scalia's dissent relative to this issue, he says he opens the door for this future case.
Yeah, and Justice Roberts has been doing a lot of this, and the Roberts Court has been doing a lot of this, instead of just a straight overruling established precedent. They chip at it a little bit here, and they change the law a little bit there, and pretty soon there isn't much left. So that may very well be what's going to happen here.
I mean, could there be, is there any other possible scenario?
Yeah, I mean, they can do, I mean, the district court in this case, which was a very conservative judge, I mean, he was a handpicked judge for this case, Judge Vinson in Florida. He initially refused to dismiss this claim. He said, you know, he dismissed a bunch of the claims that were pretty frivolous, but he didn't dismiss this claim. But then when it got to summary judgment, he said, well, you know, I feel your pain, but the law is pretty clear here and I have to uphold the law. And it may be the Supreme Court will do the same thing. I think that's actually the most likely result here. But it's going to be interesting to see what they say, and I think probably spending clause the constitutional law will not be the same after this case.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and it's a really, I think, a great insight for people who don't really focus that much on the Supreme Court, on how the court works, because these judges aren't just ruling on this case. They are looking to create a body of law and that will be cited 20 or 30 years from now.
Sure.
This could be the first step, you know, so that, you know, 30 years from now or 10 years from now, first the drinking age type of leveraging, and then by 30 years from now, they'll get to that point where they realize, the federal government can't do this.
Although that is kind of an upside here, too, because there's a lot of federal programs that conservatives like. And the Supreme Court may be reluctant to just step into the mess and throw out federal spending conditions altogether. I think they are looking to future cases, to other government programs, and that may be some protection for the Medicaid program.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Professor Timothy Jost from Washington Lee University Law School, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And if it's possible that you can give me an honorary degree, because I think I've been on sabbatical for 20 years. I don't think they're going to let me back.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Say to Napu Pay.